Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
And now in depth on what they said and what we learned.
You called it the gold standard of trade deals. You said it's the finest deal you've ever seen.
No.
And then you heard what I said about it, and all of a sudden you were against it.
Well, Donald, I know you live in your own reality, but that is not the fact.
That's what it sounded like last night at the first presidential debate. Our analysis today, did we learn something, not just about the candidates' policy positions, but about the principles that they hold? Did we learn anything about how they'd make decisions under pressure? Did we get some insight into their character? As our guests contemplate this, I want to hear from you, too. Was there a moment in last night's debate where you got a glimpse of something that you didn't know about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, where you got some perspective on how they might make a tough decision as commander-in-chief? So we're going to talk about some of the interactions that happened, but I also want to talk about insights, perspectives on who they would be and how they would make decisions as a potential president. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Our guest this hour, Wendy Schiller, is chair of the political science department at Brown. I know she was watching last night because she was on Twitter. Wendy, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie.
Van Newkirk is with us. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers politics and policy. And he's with us today from Washington. Van, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Van, we spend a lot of time on this show talking about policy issues. I think it's also kind of essential to try to analyze a candidate's decision-making process, a candidate's character. And I wondered if you got any new insight on that last night as you watched.
Well, I think the one new thing that we got was from Donald Trump. And that was when pushed on policy issues, his general preferred stance to policy solutions tends to be, I would stop them before they happened. And that's a very difficult sort of thing to quantify, and I guess that's why it's such an easy policy platform to put forward. But when asked about trade, when asked about terrorism, when asked about security issues and police issues, he's generally preferred to say, I would stop this problem before it starts. And you can't really press on exactly how you would stop those things. And I think it shows an implicit contradiction because he's also running on the fact that these issues exist.
I think, Wendy, that's a really interesting insight. So he's saying I'd be so proactive that we wouldn't get ourselves into the kind of problems that the United States is usually catching up with to try to solve. Did you hear that?
Yeah, I mean, in general, my read on policy for Trump is that he's good on some things, right? He's very good on the loss of jobs in particular parts of the country as a result of NAFTA policies for 20 years and WTO and China and now the TPP, which is not yet enforced, but would probably cost some people some jobs, although they'd bring other jobs here. So he's very good on what he knows and feels comfortable with, and that happens to be a very resonant issue in key parts of the country heading into this election. So, but when he ventures into things he hasn't done any reading on or doesn't know anything about, that's when I think he really undoes the ground that he makes up when he's talking about trade and unemployment and also just sort of conflict in general, whether it's in the United States or around the world. He just seems at a loss for particulars on policies.
You know, here's something about what you just said that I've been curious about. He runs a business. He knows that you have to know your stuff to be effective. There are, though, things, Wendy, that it does seem either his interest doesn't extend to or he's not sure what he thinks about it, that it's clear he didn't prepare for. Do you have some idea about why that might be? You know he was being urged by his campaign staff to brush up on some of this stuff.
Well, you know, being president is a really difficult job. I mean, I think everybody would recognize that. And when you haven't had any government experience, but that's, of course, the thing that's propelled you through the primary and won the nomination on, and now propelling your campaign, you know, that's an advantage, except that you don't know anything about most of the policies that the United States has to be involved with domestically and in foreign policy. It's very hard to learn that in a couple of days. And he took credit for it at the end of the debate, saying, well, I was out campaigning, I didn't prepare. So even if he had prepared, I'm just not persuaded that he would have had as broad an answer on policy as Hillary Clinton has. It doesn't mean she'll win the election. It just means I'm not sure he can catch up at this point in the campaign.
And Van, that we should also acknowledge, though, that said, that he perhaps doesn't know what he thinks about a myriad of different issues has not hurt him, because we hear a lot of voters dismissing the idea of experience, the ones that support him.
Yeah, I think this is why he's so effective, is he's really good at saying, you know, what's wrong. And I think in a time of economic turmoil, when lots of people are losing their jobs, when people are really afraid, that's what resonates with them, a lot of people. And I think they're not looking for necessarily someone who has all the answers, which is interesting. And I think we've seen that time and time again where, you know, people are not, and they know that Donald Trump doesn't really have the answers on, say, climate change or exactly the specific
very complex issues, right?
Right, right. Very complex issues. And I think they know.
Call here from Dan. Oh, go ahead, Wendy. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Van's making a really important point. I think the thing for the dynamics moving forward in the next 6 weeks on this election is, where do those people live? You know, the hardest hit areas where generations have lost jobs and the kids have to move away because they can't stay there and work anymore. Those are in particular sectors of the country that are being really fought over in this election. I think a lot of other parts of the country are doing fine and better. So I think it really highlights the challenge of appealing in a presidential race across the entire 50 states of the United States.
You're talking about places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, some of those Rust Belt states. Before that debate last night, Wendy, it looks like even in some of those battleground polls in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I mean, there's one poll that shows him just about even within the standard margin of error, and the rest show him a couple of points behind. But yeah, and in North Carolina, it's tied. North Carolina has a lot of issues going on right now. There's a lot of people who lost their jobs, but then there's a lot of other sectors that have grown up in Northern North Carolina that aren't responsive to Trump's messaging. So it's a question of, do all those people vote, and do they outnumber the rest of the people who feel like they have recovered in the economy or that their landscape has changed economically, but it's for the better?
A call here from Joy in Cannon Falls. Hi, Joy. How are you thinking about what you saw last night?
Hi, good morning. Well, I'm not sure that we saw anything that we didn't know before. We saw one candidate, you know, who's obviously, as she said, you know, prepared for the job pretty much her entire life. And then we have a candidate who's, you know, appears to be winging it from the hip on everything he does. And in normal circumstances, I'd say that, you know, the one who's prepared is obviously the one who's going to get the job. But we seem to be in the midst of a change election, and people are, you know, really, you know, it's appealing to a certain percentage of the population that he isn't prepared for the job and that he is just swinging from the hip.
Yeah, and Joy, let me pick up on that with Van. Van, and I think that is viewed, I heard this morning on Morning Edition, they were in Georgia and they were talking to some voters. I think that is viewed, as we've acknowledged, as an asset. I'm new to this. I don't have all the talking points and the answers and the 20-point plans. That's refreshing to a number of voters. We should acknowledge that.
Well, right. And that's one of the things I saw in the lead up to the debate was the argument about fact checking. And I think some people advanced the argument that fact checking actually helps Donald Trump, because like we were just talking about, there's a whole portion of this country where maybe the fact-checking doesn't quite check out, where maybe, you know, we are net onshoring jobs, but not necessarily in North Carolina. And so I think you see there's lots of folks who are like, you know, maybe all these prepared answers, or they think maybe all these prepared answers about the economy just don't reflect people who understand their reality. And I think when we hear people say, when we hear Trump surrogates say he knows the working class, that's really what we're driving at here.
Wendy, I have to say, at the very beginning of the debate where they were talking about jobs and what Van is saying about manufacturing jobs leaving, you know, Trump has talked about this a lot in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and North Carolina. He said, believe me, we're going to make sure that these companies cannot leave. We're going to, you know, he talked about Ford moving. But that was a real moment to try to dig in on what he would do about that. I don't think Lester Holt followed up on that. Hillary Clinton didn't seem to really demand a specific answer. I think that would have been an important moment of understanding here about how he thinks about this. How did you see that?
Well, I mean, I think you're raising a really good point about missed opportunities in this debate. But, you know, the old saying, people do what they can do. If he had answers, if he had proposals, if he had detailed policy to really encourage companies to stay here and not take their jobs and profits overseas and hire new workers, he would have told us in the debate. This was a perfect opening for him to reshape his brand, keep his followers, but extend outwards by really providing more information about exactly how he would do these things, and he just didn't take advantage of that at all. So you have to think either A, he doesn't have specific policies, or B, he didn't practice enough for the debate. So for the country, you sort of hope it's the latter, but it could possibly be that he just simply hasn't thought out the policies because he's an outsider, and that's the downside of running this outsider campaign.
Wendy Schiller with us this morning from Brown, and Van Newkirk with us from The Atlantic as we analyze what we saw and heard last night in the debate, whether we got some new perspective, some new insight on how these candidates would make some decisions, what they came to the debate knowing and being ready to discuss. And I'm asking you whether you got a glimpse of something that you didn't know about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, where you got some perspective on how they might make their decisions and the policies that they would prioritize as president. 800-242-2828. If you get a busy signal, call us back. I know we've got a lot of lines ringing here. 651-227-6000. And on Twitter at CarrieNPR to Ben in Cambridge. Hi, Ben. Did you learn something last night?
Yeah. Who Trump is at heart, I thought it was a huge revelation last night that Senator Clinton suggested he may not pay taxes, and Trump kind of bragged that he thought that not paying taxes was smart.
Here's that exchange, Ben. We'll listen and we'll talk about it. First, Hillary Clinton.
So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Second, maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. Third, we don't know all of his business dealings, but we have been told through investigative reporting that he owes about $650 million to Wall Street and foreign banks. Or maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes.
Van, before we hear Trump's response to that, how effective was that in your view?
I thought it was extraordinarily effective, and I really hope that some things were learned here. And I think that the line of questioning about Trump's taxes, about his business deals, is perhaps the most salient line of questioning that I have as a journalist.
How so?
Well, you have a person running to be the nation's top civil servant. And I think most of us would agree that actually paying your taxes is part of where civil service starts. And also with the Trump University things, we've seen a pattern of his business deals bleeding into the sort of charitable and tax issues that he has, where it seems he's sort of siphoning off funds from the less fortunate. And there's just been a constant pattern of this with him saying, you know, cheering on, exploiting people who were affected by the recession and the housing crash. Like, those are things that should disturb people about someone running to be the top civil servant.
And here is how Donald Trump responded to that. Let's listen.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted.
So, Wendy, what we didn't hear there was when he cut in over Hillary Clinton and said, that's because I'm smart, basically saying, you know, smart people don't pay as little federal tax as they possibly can. So if I'm not paying much in federal tax, that's a good thing.
Well, yeah, but he also made the tactical error of also saying that during the housing crisis, when she sort of hit him on that he had been quoted as saying he made a lot of money when people lost their houses and he bought up more real estate for cheaper prices, that that's what a good business person does. And I think people who want a good business person might be attracted to that, but people who are looking for a president who's compassionate, who's really interested in fixing the economy, you know, it's kind of a contrast to say, you know, trade stole all your jobs and I'm going to bring them back and make your life better, and then, oh, by the way, when I can, I make money off your misfortune. So I think they were contradicting each other, and so it was hard for him to get that cohesive message out about how he would help people economically.
Call here from Dan in Rochester. Hey, good morning, Dan. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. So I thought it was pretty remarkable that Donald Trump had not pushed the gun control, how he would, you know, eliminate gun-free zones on his first day. And even that Hillary Clinton, you know, didn't talk about gun control, but gun safety measures. And I think that's a pretty hot button issue for a lot of people, even maybe even a one topic issue. And it just really wasn't discussed in the debate.
Yeah, Van, this is an interesting point because I have been getting some direct mail at my house. I live over the border in Wisconsin, and a lot of it has been about, if Hillary Clinton is able to appoint the next Supreme Court justice, they're going to erase gun rights. I mean, there's been a lot of marketing and outreach on this, but I haven't heard it on the campaign trail much. What do you make of that?
Well, I think especially last night with the debate, that bit of debate is sort of superseded by stuff like the Charlotte protest. Mm. And I think Trump's appeal when he goes into the 68 Nixon mode and says he's a candidate of law and order is I think appealing to the same idea and the same segment of voters who would be affected by the gun control. And I think Clinton actually spoke to gun control in her response to the same question. And I think now we're wrapping this idea of gun control into our broader discourse about violence.
Yeah, Van, I don't know what to make of some of the phrases and the overall view that Donald Trump has about this very, what did he say, that African-Americans are living in hell. I mean, he has this very dark kind of dystopian view of part of America. Go ahead.
Sorry, if you think that African Americans live in the inner city, I think you should probably take some, catch up on your history with where residential patterns are happening. As a African American man, I have not yet been shot walking down the street. So that's just, I think it's very interesting things he's saying here.
Yeah, Wendy, I hear what Van is saying here. I mean, if you look at some of the new geographic patterns, a lot of African Americans and Americans of color live out in the suburbs. White Americans are moving back into the inner city. He seems to have this view of Americans of color that I think sounds like, maybe as Van suggested, the late 1960s.
Yeah, I think Van's absolutely right. I thought the same thing. I thought 1960s, 1970s. And it really, again, you can draw lines across comments. So when Hillary Clinton attacked him on the Justice Department's suit against him on racial discrimination in his buildings that he first started out in the early, mid-1970s, he said, "We settled that without admitting guilt." And it's as if he's stuck in that time frame and how he perceives people. And the challenge for the Trump campaign is that if you want to win North Carolina, you've got Raleigh, Durham, you've got, you know, Charlotte obviously having some problems now, but in Philadelphia, in Pittsburgh, all over the country, if you want to get any slice of the millennials, you know, this is just sounds like a time warp in the way that he describes people. And I don't think it's seen as contributing, except by people who have these sort of stereotypical views of race and crime in the inner city capacity to begin with. There is that base for Donald Trump, but it's not big enough to win this election. I don't think so anyway.
Mark on Twitter says Trump referenced Reagan's jobs growth numbers, skipping over President Clinton. Yes, by design, I'm sure, who added more jobs than Reagan, Bush 1 and 2 combined. Gene says, what startled me was his flippant attitude towards foreign countries. Hillary Clinton was right to calm other countries regarding the election. And Steph, off the page.
Jeff says, I found the fact that Trump wants to use the secret terrorist watch list to remove Second Amendment rights from people to be eye-opening. We didn't know his position on that issue until the debate. And Hillary made a direct reference to military-style weapons. Basically, she's saying she wants to make the AR-15 illegal. After last night, I'm glad I'm supporting Johnson.
I want to have you both listen to an excerpt of the back and forth over this birth certificate controversy. I think there were some revealing things said about this from Donald Trump last night. So this is Donald Trump first, and then we'll hear Hillary Clinton on this.
What do you say to Americans?
Well, it was very, I say nothing. I say nothing because I was able to get him to produce it. He should have produced it a long time before. I say nothing. But let me just tell you, when you talk about healing, I think that I've developed very, very good relationships over the last little while with the African-American community. I think you can see that. And I feel that they really wanted me to come to that conclusion. And I think I did a great job and a great service, not only for the country, but even for the president, in getting him to produce his birth certificate.
Secretary Clinton.
You know, Van, I'm trying to take this at face value. It just seems so disconnected to the facts.
Yeah, I think the idea that he's presenting there that black people wanted him to produce
that's what he's saying
a birth certificate or question the Americanness of the first black president that just strikes me as patently false.
Well, yeah, and I and Van, I also thought it was absurd that he had a press conference and that all the mainstream media covered it for him to announce that he had finally decided that President Obama was born in the United States. It was absurd. And I thought it was ridiculous that he got all that attention. It's patently false. He started it or picked it up for his own purposes. And, you know, I got one number for you. Obama's at 54% approval in the latest Gallup poll. So, and other polls have him anywhere from 51 to 54% approval. This is the administration Hillary Clinton is running on to follow. So not only is there the race issue involved and the credibility of truth involved, but you're going after somebody that people are deciding that they like at the end of his term, enough that if enough of them think Hillary will be like Obama, that could also give her the edge in some of these states. So it's a campaign mistake as much as any other kind of mistake.
So here's what Secretary Clinton said in response to Donald Trump's remarks about the birther controversy.
Just listen to what you heard. And clearly, as Donald just admitted, he knew he was going to stand on this debate stage and Lester Holt was going to be asking us questions. So he tried to put the whole racist birther lie to bed. But it can't be dismissed that easily. He has really started his political activity based on this racist lie that our first black president was not an American citizen.
Wendy, I don't want to miss that. She's right, isn't she? That is how Donald Trump came back, you know, after The Apprentice and after some of the other stuff he was doing. This is how he re-entered the political realm, questioning President Obama's heritage.
Right. So the other thing is that what this also illustrates is micro-targeting, as people have been talking about in this debate. So Donald Trump reminds his adamant supporters who don't believe that the president was born in the United States, and there are, you know, some percentage of people who support Trump who believe that. And so he's targeting them and saying, hey, you know, sort of a wink to them. Look, I said I didn't think, you know, I believe it now, but I don't really believe it. And she, you know, really needs African-American turnout to stay high. It was 60 66.6 or 67% in 2012. She really needs that turnout to be high. So whenever she could in that debate, she reminded African-American voters that she has their economic, their criminal justice, and their symbolic interests at heart. So every chance she got, she positioned herself with the people she needs to win, and he tried to do the same. But I think the problem for him is that it alienated, I believe, or it could alienate independent voters or dissatisfied Republicans who might be kind of thinking about going back to their party this election. When they hear things like that, they think, nope, can't go that far.
Well, I mean, and that's exactly it, Van, isn't it? That a lot of his positioning around voters of color has been giving a bit of comfort and ease to white voters who are in his base who don't want to see themselves as sharing what appears to be racist perceptions. But last night, I think he undid whatever, you know, whatever he's been trying to do around that.
Right. And I think we've seen these instances of what people are calling outreach over the last couple of weeks that to me seem to just be reinforcement of stereotypes, especially, you know, we talk about black people being in hell or in these, you know, awful cityscapes. But at the very least, he had it. He could credibly claim that he actually had some compassion. After this debate and after he goes on air and brags about not kicking people of color out of one $200,000 club in Palm Beach, I don't know if we can, you know, I don't know if he can still credibly claim that. And I think that's going to hurt him in Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
To the phones to DeMario, driving on the road. Hi, good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thanks for having me. But the reason I called, there was one thing about the debate last night that Secretary Clinton missed that I think that she would have said a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And what that was that when they were talking about the birth certificate issue, and she was mentioning about the first black president and him not being a citizen, you know, Trump had said during that exchange, "You're president." So
that's right.
Clinton could have came back and said, "So we're running for the highest office in the land, the president of the United States, and if this is my president, then what kind of president are you striving to be?
Yeah.
Are you striving to be a president to just one segment of people or everyone?"
Yeah, no, really good point. Wendy, I noted that, too. And then I thought, well, is he saying you're president because President Obama's a Democrat and so is Hillary Clinton? But it also kind of pinged in the back of my mind that he was kind of reinforcing that illegitimacy as president issue that I think DeMario heard, too. What would you say?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's exactly what he was doing. And I think it was, you know, I think he was listening to his campaign handlers. He was prepped to do that. You know, these debates are first and foremost solidifying your base and firing them up and making sure at these closing weeks of photo registration now and the beginning of early voting to make sure they stay impassioned and get out the door because you can't win without them. So that's what he was doing last night. It's one of the few ways in which I think he was actually following his campaign advisor's advice. And I think it backfires with the people that he doesn't think necessarily will vote for him. And we'll have to see about the Trump Organization and the Republican National Committee. Do they have the kind of ground game, the ground army, that will identify those people on the fence in the next 6 weeks and really go try to get them to Trump's side? We just haven't seen any evidence of that yet. And I think that's the follow-up to these debates. So in the next week, we're going to have to see whether the campaigns push the campaign part into gear here.
Or Wendy, do those, I mean, this is going to play out, I think, in a state like Wisconsin. Do they decide, the RNC and these candidates that are down ballot, decide, forget Trump, this is really all about survival in the House and the Senate, it's about us? And that's where the game is played.
Well, I'd be curious to hear what Van thinks about this, but I think I don't think they're ready to do that yet because they can't win a lot of these House seats for the Republicans. They need this base to turn out, to solidify, make sure they keep their majority.
Well, but they are going to keep their majority, aren't they?
Some senators are bringing their voters with them. Russ Feingold is bringing a lot of progressives in Wisconsin with him. He's a bunch of points ahead of Ron Johnson, the Republican incumbent. So if Hillary Clinton wins Wisconsin, it's because of Ron Johnson or Russ Feingold in the Senate contest. So same thing in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. So, I mean, I think there's different kinds of factors at the lower levels, congressional and Senate, that are secondary weights on this election. And these Senate campaigns that are well organized, like Colorado is a pretty popular Democrat incumbent, he's going to try to get his people out to vote. That's going to help Hillary Clinton. So I think it depends on where you have a contested Senate race and whether that Senate race will get some of these partisans out, including partisans who would vote, would stay home if it was just Trump, but they'll get out the door, like in Ohio, to reelect Rob Portman. That could give Ohio to Trump.
Van, what do you think?
Well, I think the Republican redistricting strategy that we've seen play out over the last few elections sort of necessitates having a strong presidential candidate on the ticket to get people in these rural areas that don't have a whole lot of voters that do have or spread out and do have now House seats that have been carved out for them. And I think especially in North Carolina and you look throughout the South where this is happening, they need, and I don't think they can, you know, they've hitched their wagons to Trump, and they have to get people out there who are motivated to vote for Trump so they can vote for their representative. And I think that's just how the strategy has to work.
But there will be people in some of these tightly contested Senate races. I mean, I'm asking, can they rely on some ticket splitters? I mean, maybe independents who come out and may end up voting for Clinton at the top of the ticket, but like their U.S. senator or like their representative. Not enough of those to make a difference, or what?
That's where your information, that's where Obama had such a phenomenal organization in 2012, right? That's where, you know, your profiling of voters, figuring out who voted before, have they ever split their vote? I mean, really block by block of key places like Northern Virginia, for example, you know, suburbs of Philadelphia. There's tremendous amounts of information in the Clinton campaign. I think the Trump campaign has a lot of that same information. So does the Republican Senate Campaign Committee. And if they think that they can get that going, Kerry, they're going to do that in a state like Ohio. We say, listen, we're not going to bother you about the presidential race, but Rob Portman's essential to Ohio, right? So you have to get out the door and vote for the Republican Senate campaign candidate. So that's where I think old-fashioned campaign dynamics, particularly for the House and Senate parties, I think that's what comes into play in November. I think they may not publicly separate from Trump, but they're organizationally separating from Trump.
Barbara says about what she learned last night in the debate on Twitter, Alicia Machado doubling down today about her weight. I think she's talking about Trump this morning on morning TV. She says there's more important things, economy, ISIS, but he justifies his behavior. And step off the page.
Yeah, a lot of people are frustrated by talking about the birther movement and other stuff. Jay said, let's talk about how Trump wants to cut waste and corruption in politics to get us more for our tax dollar. And Maggie says, I found the conversation on gun control to be the most illuminating of each candidate's grasp of what it means to be president. Instead of making a case for his own policy, Donald Trump made vast and offensive generalizations about communities of color. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, presented a well-rounded, sensible policy on guns that touched on a number of issues that lead to gun violence today.
Call here from Melissa in Minneapolis. Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. Tell me what you're thinking about today.
Yeah, after watching the debate, as a previous Republican that has decided to leave the party and never go for a Republican president again,
wow,
because of what they have done with Donald Trump, I think that it's time for a new conservative movement, a conservative movement that is compassionate, that celebrates diversity and tolerance. And that's why this year I'm going to be voting for Evan McMullen. I think that he is a person that in Minnesota, both Bernie voters and Minnesota conservatives that voted Rubio and Cruz can really stand behind, because he is about little government, but he's also about tolerance and diversity.
So, Melissa, have you been a Republican voter up to this presidential race, or have you moved around?
You know what? I'm unique because I am a Latina female that recently became an American citizen in the last 6 years. So I've had a chance to vote in two elections, and I vote across the ballot. I vote my values and not for a specific party. And so this year, when I saw the two choices in both the Democratic and the Republican Party, there was no way that I could vote for either. And so that's why this year I'm going to be voting Evan McMullen. There are times where I have voted Democrat, actually quite a few times, you know, But this year I can't say that I'm going to be voting just on one side.
Okay. I appreciate the call. If you're just tuning in, it's a conversation, of course, about what was said, what happened last night on the stage at Hofstra College, where the first presidential debate took place. Wendy Schiller is with us from Brown University, Van Newkirk with us, where he writes about policy and politics at The Atlantic. And I'm asking you for your perspective. What did you learn, if anything, about either of the candidates? I don't know that we've gotten to this idea about how they make decisions. You know, tomorrow, by the way, at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk about temperament, because that came up. I'm going to talk to Wendy and Van about that as well. What else did you see? What issues did you want to hear more about? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, and back to your calls and questions on the other side of news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. They clashed throughout their first presidential debate. Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a typical politician and said she has experience, just bad experience. Clinton suggested Trump does not want to make his federal tax returns public because of something he's hiding. The televised face-off was the most anticipated moment in the election campaign so far, and today both candidates are back out on the campaign trail. The two vice presidential candidates, unsurprisingly, saw their running mates as debate winners. Democrat Tim Kaine says Donald Trump looked like he was running out of gas, and Republican Mike Pence accused Hillary Clinton of launching an avalanche of insults at Trump. On NBC, Kaine said he thought Trump offered few specifics on policies. Pence countered Trump was focused on the issues the American people care about. A city spokeswoman for Cedar Rapids, Iowa, says a temporary flood protection system is holding as the Cedar River rises toward its expected crest of 23 feet. That's 11 feet above flood stage. Sarah Boffman says there is some minor roadway flooding from storm sewer backup just west of the river downtown, but she says the water is being pumped back into the river. Firefighters in Northern California are gaining ground against a wildfire near a geothermal power producing facility in Sonoma County, but another blaze has become more ferocious. A fire in Santa Cruz in the mountains there has destroyed one home and is threatening hundreds of others. The fast-moving blaze in what's Santa Clara County charred 500 acres by last night and forced evacuations as well. And one firefighter was killed this morning in the Bronx, New York, after a house exploded. Firefighters responded to a report of a gas leak at the time. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
We talk a lot about politics heading up to the general election. If you can't listen to the whole show, here's the good news. You can always find the conversations on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's on demand. It's all about you. Tune in.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
I agree. She's got experience, but it's bad experience. And this country can't afford to have another 4 years of that kind of experience.
We are at the...
I have a feeling that by the end of this evening, I'm going to be blamed for everything that's ever happened.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah, why not?
You want to approve Trans-Pacific Partnership. You were totally in favor of it. Then you heard what I was saying, how bad it is, and you said, I can't win that debate.
I think Donald just criticized me for preparing for this debate. And yes, I did. And you know what else I prepared for? I prepared to be president. And I think that's a good thing.
Because the people that are most affected by what's happening are African-American and Hispanic people. And it's very unfair to them what our politicians are allowing to happen.
And he really believes that the more you help wealthy people, the better off we'll be, and that everything will work out from there. I don't buy that.
Some of the sounds of the debate last night, and that's what we're talking about today with Wendy Schiller from Brown University and Van Newkirk with us from The Atlantic. Wendy, to go back to that moment of where Hillary Clinton says, you know what else I prepared for? I prepared to be president. Yes, I prepared for the debate. A meaningful moment to you or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the timing of the moment. So, you know, she carefully, it's like a football game, right? You know, it's four quarters. If you're from the New England area, you know, you cite Bill Belichick all the time. It's four-quarter football. And Donald Trump did very well, I think, in the first quarter, sort of half good in the second quarter, particularly on trade. And even his point about crime and the fact that disproportionately Latino and African Americans who live in poor neighborhoods are subject to higher rates of crime. And they're not well served by a lot of the politicians in their communities in reducing that crime. That's a legitimate issue. That's a really important issue. So he even had some moments. But by the third quarter, fourth quarter, he was fading badly. And she saved some of her best lines for the end, where he was running out of gas. And she looked as vibrant and strong as when she started the debate. So it was a well-measured, I think, performance by Hillary Clinton in that way.
Van, tomorrow at 9, we're going to talk about temperament. And I don't mean this thing. I know there's a lot of, there's been diagnoses at a distance of Trump and his alleged narcissism and all that. I really want to ask more the questions for how we understand it when the candidates are talking about temperament, because a lot of people of a lot of different temperaments have been successful, you know, with a lot of different kinds of personalities. Is this an important question to you, or is it a way that just Hillary Clinton has found to really get under his skin?
I think it is an important question, because I do think sort of the offhand comments, the remarks, the bearing of the president does have a really actual substantial impact on, I think, mostly a lot of, on foreign policy. Mm-hmm. So we talk about a president in Trump who would, I think, have his fair share of gaffes, of not remembering names, of threatening to run a protectionism racket with Japan. And I think those are not things that will serve us well in the foreign policy arena. And, the president is our first diplomat in face of the world, and I think that does matter.
Van, I was reading something in The Atlantic, in your magazine this morning, when I think you put this on the cover. You had psychologist Dan McAdams, right? Do you remember this? Write about Trump's personality? And here's something that I pulled out that I'll probably use for tomorrow. But McAdams says, more than even Ronald Reagan, Trump seems supremely cognizant of the fact that he's always acting. He moves through life like a man who knows he's always being observed. If all human beings are, by their very nature, social actors, then Donald Trump seems to be more so superhuman in this one primal sense. And I was thinking, a lot of politicians who are in the public eye have this, you can kind of see their personas change with this acknowledgement that they are always on display, always being observed. Is he any more like that than a lot of the other politicians? He just doesn't hide it as well as they do?
Well, I think if you consider his career as a reality TV star and as a wrestling personality, he's actually had more time under the lights than a lot of politicians that we see coming into the presidency. And so I think he's developed a pretty well, you know, established persona, and it's played out for decades now. And the Trump persona, I think you see it with a lot of politicians, actually. This one of the big criticisms of Clinton that I think has subsided recently is that she's been, you know, we know too much about her. And we know too much about her persona and personality, and people think she doesn't show the real Hillary Clinton anymore. And I think those are actual things that we've seen happen with Donald Trump throughout his career.
Wendy, what would you say?
Well, I mean, I think that's all true. He's a performer, right? But I think you have to make the transition as a politician, particularly from party politics or celebrity personality politics, to, you know, showing you can run the country, that you have the temperament, he's not wrong about that, but that you have the knowledge and the expertise. And I think what debates are about is figuring out whether you do have the temperament, that you can conduct yourself in a way that looks presidential and appears presidential and will, as you say, man, represent the United States to the world all the time. And at the end of the debate, he sort of said, I have a temperament. It's great for winning. It's just, I'm not persuaded that's exactly what voters are looking for in the president, maybe to win the election, yes, but to be president. And so he has two more opportunities. We know that, you know, Obama lost the first debate and won the election. election. He was an incumbent, though, with a track record. So I think it's a little bit different for Trump, who still has to establish himself. But John Kerry won all three debates against George W. Bush in 2004 and still lost the election.
Didn't
so
matter.
It's just unclear to me how much this debate will, or any of the debates, will move voters. But in such a tight race, even small movements might really matter.
Bell says online, struck by how much Trump quantified everything by whether or not it made money or will make money. And Johnny says on Twitter here, I learned that this wasn't a big farce designed to reveal the flaws of our political process. Trump is actually running for president. Yeah, he is. Step off the page.
Carl says, so according to your panel's comments this morning, Trump has outdated alarmist attitudes about the lives of minorities, that things are pretty good for them. So now I'm feeling less concerned about racial and economic gaps. Thanks, guys.
Okay, Van, you want to respond to that? And then Wendy.
Well, I think there's a material difference between saying this is the best, you know, this is the worst that minorities have ever been. You know, we had Jim Crow, we had slavery; those are pretty bad. And there's a difference between saying that and saying, you know, we are exactly where we need to be in this country in terms of racial justice and economic justice. I think what people are looking for is for a candidate who assesses the situation, finds out what's wrong, and prescribes actual solutions to fixing that. And that means not dipping into hyperbole and selling that hyperbole as reality with no solutions to actually fix the hyperbolic problem.
Wendy, this is where I wish we had the opportunity for debates on one question. Can you imagine 90 minutes of really of a question, as has been raised from our writer here, about and I mean, you know, Lester Holt tried to ask about racial healing, and he asked this complicated question and then said to Hillary Clinton, 2 minutes on that, please. Can you imagine the true in-depth discussion that we would have if we took one question about that and explored it for 90 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, I think you would also get a sense of people's experiences, right? The Clintons, he was governor of Arkansas. Hillary Clinton was a northerner, a Midwesterner, and lived in the South. And one of the sort of things about Bill Clinton among African Americans was, before there was Barack Obama, there was Bill Clinton. And mm-hmm. they're very close in terms of the African American community in a lot of places in the country. Trump just seemed like he just didn't ever socialize or interact with African Americans. Like, he just had no concept of you know, who they are, what their economics are, what their education is. You know, they're just the other to him. And I think that's just a gulf he can't fix. And I don't know that he could fix it even in 90 minutes, because that takes life experience. And I just think between the Clintons and Trump, I think you just don't get anything close to equality on that life experience.
Well,
so
that's
the thing. I'm curious to see how much President Barack Obama will get out in the campaign trail now. I mean, he's still president. He's got a job to do. But will the Clinton campaign really use him in the last 6 weeks to, you know, get those African American voters out the door the same as they did for him, even if it's only 85% the same? She really needs that. And I'm curious to see, you know, whether he becomes really a surrogate on this question about himself and his presidency, but on race relations as well. I mean, we've only got 6 weeks, but I'm curious to see.
So are you suggesting that he might be reluctant, or that the Clinton campaign may not be deploying him the way they could? And now it's time to rethink that.
I don't think he's reluctant. I think you can see President Obama has taken every single opportunity to sort of insert himself into this campaign, because it's obviously, you know, partly a referendum on his 8 years in office. So that's natural. I don't know what the thinking is there, but I just think back to when Al Gore kind of shut Bill Clinton out because of Monica Lewinsky in 2000,
right,
wouldn't use him as a surrogate, and, you know, lost for a lot of reasons. But that's got to be thought of as one of the reasons. So it would be a waste of talent not to use the president, particularly on this very important resident issue. He gave an incredible speech. I recommend everybody go to YouTube and watch it for the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And I think that's something that, in this particular arena, that you're looking for conversation about this issue, I think he's the guy to engage in that conversation, even now at the end of his term.
By the way, at the top of the next hour, we're going to be talking about some of the artifacts in that museum and hearing a bit of that speech that President Obama gave. Van, what would you say about that?
Well, I think I was here for his speeches 2 weeks ago at the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and I attended one of those. And I think it's interesting to me that he gave two really resonant and powerful speeches on behalf of Hillary Clinton. And I think those would be very effective on the trail. I think those would be very effective at getting Latino voters out to register and to vote in North Carolina, especially where we know that if they increase Latino turnout by 4 or 5 percentage points, it's almost in the bag for Democrats mm-hmm. in the state. And I think seeing him on the trail giving that same speech that he gave to mostly people in the Beltway on the ground would have a really big effect.
Call here from Jenny in St. Paul. Hi, Jenny. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Hey. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to talk about that comment about the hackers and how there's some guy at home. It's not Russia. It's some guy at home who probably weighs 400 pounds.
Sitting on his bed,
you know,
right?
He's the sixth grade bully that, you know, you guys said something about he acts like he's always on and people are watching him. Like the sixth grade bully who's standing there beating people up so that everybody laughs. And, you know, he's just a mean person.
Jenny Van does bring up, I really saw Twitter kind of flame when Donald Trump was talking about the hackers and that it's somebody 400 pounds sitting on his bed hacking. Revealing to you about anything or not? And why did people react the way they did, do you think?
Well, I think most of the issue there is there seems to be a really big issue among the candidates about speaking about hacking in a way that doesn't sound dinosaurish. And I think, you know, most of people who are connected know how sophisticated hacking is and know how it's done and really fear state actors in the hacking realm. And to see him sort of throw back to this idea of like 1980s hackers a movie is interesting. And also, you know, he is a bully. And this is him being performative and saying, you know, he loves talking about people's weight. And I don't know, that just seems to be the Trump persona at this point.
Wendy, I want to get in one last exchange or one last remark from Donald Trump about stamina. It came up when Lester Holt asked about whether Hillary Clinton looks presidential, and I was so happy that he brought this up. So here's Donald Trump.
You have so many different things you have to be able to do, and I don't believe that Hillary has the stamina.
Let's let her respond.
Well, as soon as he travels to 112 countries and negotiates a peace deal, a ceasefire, a release of dissidents, an opening of new opportunities in nations around the world, or even spends 11 hours testifying in front of a congressional committee, he can talk to me about stamina.
Wendy, she was really ready for that one, wasn't she?
Yeah, but it was a terrific response. But had she not looked pretty good last night, very energetic, very on point? She didn't take a sip of water once, and he was drinking a lot of water. It reminds you of Marco Rubio during the president.
I thought of that too.
Right. I mean, I think had she not looked as good and energetic and sharp as she did, that would not have resonated the same way. He picked the wrong time once again to make that point in the debate. It's just bad debating practice, and he's got to get much better coaching. And in fact, he's got to be willing to be coached for the next debate, because if it's just more of the same, I just don't think it helps him expand the base. And I think, you know, making fun of people who struggle with their weight, you know, it just seems to me never a good campaign tactic. And so I don't understand why he'd even, you know, he just can't control what he's saying. But that's certainly not a way to win votes. So I think she knew when to say what she needed to say and how to say it last night as an experienced debater. The very experience that he criticized, I think, was what helped her for most people in terms of just winning this debate.
Wendy and Van, really grateful that you got up a little early with us this morning to talk about this. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Gary.